Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Terrell Johnson was a 24-year-old from Portland, Oregon. On May 10, 2017, he was at a Max Light Rail station in southeast Portland, threatening people with a utility knife. Witnesses say he was clearly demonstrating signs of mental illness and distress. The Portland police were called, and Officer Samson Ajir shot Terrell Johnson multiple times, killing him. The Multnomah County Grand Jury found the use of force justified, but after an independent study of the shooting found that police bureau policy was violated, a lawsuit resulted in a $600,000 settlement in the officer's fatal shooting of Terrell Johnson. My guest is Juan Chavez, a civil rights attorney with the Oregon Justice Resource Center, who represented Terrell's mother, Alicia Johnson, in the case. Welcome, Juan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Juan, you represented Terrell Johnson's mother, Alicia Johnson, in the lawsuit that resulted in this settlement. So you spent a lot of time with her. So what can you tell us about Terrell Johnson? Who was this 24-year-old that was killed by Portland police?
You know, there's a lot that we don't know about the last few months of Terrell's life. But what we know before then is he was a hardworking kid who loved his parents, loved his family, and had struggles like a lot of us do with sadness, substance use. And when the time came for, you know, maybe there haven't been some intervention, multiple systems, civil and legal, kind of failed him. You know, he was the kind of guy who carried around a Bible with him. He did Bible study. He would text his mom that he cared about her and that, you know, I think he should have had a longer life than what he was given. Instead, when he tried to seek getting some sort of treatment or housing, had difficulty following up, which, you know, these bureaucratic machines are imposing and difficult to engage with in a lot of respects, or he was turned away. I think of some months before he tried getting treatment at a mental health treatment center, and he apparently got turned away for doodling on one of the chairs. I have to think that there are multiple points at which we could have intervened in his life, and there are multiple points at which I think, you know, things could have gone differently. But fundamentally, and this is I think crucial here, and much as I do want to highlight the deficiencies in our mental health support network and our housing network, none of that is an excuse for the police shooting you dead unjustifiably. The mental health system didn't kill Terrell, the Portland police did. And that's kind of the balance that you need to always keep in mind with a case like this. And we've seen it multiple times since.
But it is also the failure of our mental health and substance abuse treatment here in this state.
Right. I mean, it's significant in its contribution here. But I guess I think what a lot of people might struggle with here is understanding that people are going to have crises in the streets, and it's not the mental illness that kills you. It's getting shot. And the Portland police needs to know that either they shouldn't respond to these kind of calls, or they need to be trained better.
So May 10th, 2017, Terrell Johnson is at a Max station in southeast Portland. Witnesses see a utility knife. He's chasing people, clearly demonstrating that something's wrong. What happened that day?
Best we can tell, based on available evidence and some testimony, is that Terrell had asked a trio of people on the Max platform in southeast Portland, that's the Flavelle station. He had asked them for a cigarette, and they rebuffed him. And so there's different versions of what happens next, but from what we can tell, Terrell chased those three people around the Max station. One of the people he chased ran to his house, which was nearby, and got his dad. his dad came back with a kitchen knife and they cornered Terrell. And when a passerby drove by and called 911 saying, hey, there's a guy here with a knife, you know, it's not clear over the BOEC readout who exactly had this knife, what all is going on here, because you have a person who apparently had a utility knife and yet somebody threatening somebody else with a kitchen knife. And the person who called 911 on the Max platform as well hopped on the next Max. They were going to a Chris Brown concert. So, you know, the police arrive not necessarily sure who and all was involved with this, who allegedly had this knife, and who was menacing here. So at this time, there was a transit division of basically officers from different bureaus who were part of transit police, and three different agencies essentially responded, all part of the same transit division. The first officer who arrived was from West Lynn Police Department, and then the next car was two brothers, one who worked with the Portland Police Bureau and the other with the Clackamas County Sheriffs. That's another issue of conflicts of interest that is also touched on in an independent investigation on this. But essentially, the first officer who arrived starts talking to Terrell, asks him calmly, you know, do you want to talk to me? Do you want me to, can I pat you down? Terrell's not saying much of anything, and he's not agreeing to getting pat down, but he's acting peculiar. And, you know, mind you, earlier on the radio, it had been phoned in that there was a crazy, quote unquote, crazy homeless man who was running around and chasing people. Terrell might have put the description at this point. But, you know, this officer, by his own account, seems like he was handling the situation. He was talking calmly to Terrell. Terrell wasn't agitated. The officer asked him, do you have any weapons on you? Allegedly, Terrell said, yeah, I have a box cutter on me. And the officer said, you know, that's fine. Just don't reach for it. Terrell wasn't exactly responding like most people, I think, would when getting questioned. And that might have been alarming to the officer, but it was still just a matter of don't escalate things here. And, you know, things are under control. He's going to investigate. That changes when the two brothers arrive, the brothers Ajir. And Samson Ajir arrives, sees Terrell being talked to by this other officer, and decides to glove up. And Terrell sees that and knows what's going to happen next. Best we can tell, he had been houseless for a couple of months now. He might have been living nearby. He's probably familiar with what happens when officers, Portland police officers, glove up.
So what exactly does that mean?
Well, in the past, Terrell had a run-in with the police officers. I think most times when you see police officers gloving up, that means they're going to touch your things, maybe frisk you, maybe interact with you, arrest you, essentially. Terrell thought he was getting arrested, more than likely. And that means he's going to get roughed up. I mean, I think we've seen enough of what happens to folks under ordinary stops and searches, you know, still getting hurt, still getting their rights violated. I don't think that that's a stretch for him to have feared that moment. And again, he had been talking to this other officer, you know, for a couple of minutes now, and nothing had escalated there. And so it was just the presumption, I think, of Officer Ajir thinking that he was going to be frisking this guy.
Plus one, the sight of now three police officers on site and coming toward him, or there for Terrell, and him in the mental state that he was in, that escalates the situation itself.
No, certainly. And I will never know quite what was in his mind at that time. What we do know is that next he starts running. And this is where the wheels certainly fall off the wagon for Officer Ajir. You know, officers, it's very clear training on foot pursuits. They're dangerous. I think a kind of a preliminary study on our part, look at foot chases, they're pretty dangerous. They elevate your blood pressure. They get you all adrenaline rushing, and it puts you in dangerous situations. And when officers put themselves in dangerous situations, it's likely that force will happen, but it's unreasonably created. You can't create your own circumstances where you feel scared and you can now use deadly force. That's just, it inverts the constitutional order. But, you know, Portland police officers have a pretty clear directive on when it is that they can foot chase, and that wasn't followed here. Essentially, you're not supposed to get that close to the person you're chasing. You're supposed to use cover. You're supposed to run parallel to the person. You're supposed to use backup. You're supposed to phone in what's happening. And that's not what Samson Ajir did. He just chased him, got within 10 feet of him. And what he told the grand jury was he thought he could tire him out. Nowhere in their training or in their directives is to say, yeah, run them down until they get tired. You know, that's it. And it is, this plays out later in this tragic scenario, but I have to think that Officer Ajir really thought of himself as some commando who fought, you know, the city was his war zone action hero film set.
At what level does their training, their de-escalation techniques, or their crisis intervention training kick in? Because when Officer Ajir, they're two brothers, so there were two Officer Ajirs, when they arrived at the scene, they saw that Terrell Johnson was calmly speaking with this other third officer. They should have backed away right then. Why did they pursue him? It's mind-boggling.
It is. But it's not uncommon. You know, and I'm not saying that to excuse it, but, you know, it is, I think, the community's best experience that police officers show up and raise the temperature of the room. And that just makes it more dangerous for everybody involved. You know, there's kind of an old-fashioned idea of what police officer is and what their role is in the community that just does not exist. It likely never existed. But, you know, I think you talk to enough older officers, you know, this just wasn't their experience. They would just kind of stand on a street corner, and it wasn't necessarily an escalating presence. It was just, I'm a traffic cone, so to speak. So Officer Ajir chases Terrell within, you know, 10 feet of his proximity, and they run around Flavelle Street and kind of loop back to the Max Bridge that was crossing Johnson Creek, right there by the Max station. And here is, again, something that had Officer Ajir followed his training, he wouldn't have found himself in the situation, which is alone, out of line of sight with his other officers, chasing Terrell onto this bridge. Terrell jumps across into kind of the middle section between the tracks. Officer Ajir follows him, not necessarily noticing that Terrell had stopped at this point. Now, at this time, it is hazy what next transpires. Best we got is a passing Max Trains video feed. So you have 30 pixels dancing together. But essentially, you can tell that Terrell stops, and you can tell that Officer Ajir falls backwards after he trips on a curb. And then you see Terrell fall immediately, basically at the same time. And what Officer Ajir told the grand jury was that Terrell had started lunging at him with his box cutter. Ajir had drawn his weapon, took a step back, didn't notice that there was a curb there, falls backwards, shoots once, and as he's pushing himself back up with his other hand, he shoots three more times. So four shots, three bullets hit Terrell. And again, Officer Ajir told the grand jury that this is a man who is coming at him with a knife in his hand, practically on top of him.
Yeah. Yet he was shot in the back.
Correct. He was shot twice in the back and once across the chest. That doesn't tell me, and it certainly didn't seem like it to our experts either, that this was a man who was coming at you waving his knife. Indeed, even the shot across his chest, which traveled kind of through his breast into his bicep, would have done so only if his arm was right next to his body. So, you know, this isn't a situation where you have a person lunging at you with a stabbing implement and then twice in the back. I think it's more likely that Terrell was running away. I think it's more likely that Terrell maybe had a moment where he was either catching his breath, having ran, you know, 300 meters, and he might have tried to intimidate the officer, but one way or the other, he was going the other direction and the officer was going onto the floor and decided to shoot him. You know, you have multiple junctures at which the officer could have done something different and indeed was told to do something different by his training. And what follows is what we're all too tragically familiar with, which is a vast campaign to exonerate this officer rather than hold them accountable.
What happened next?
Well, Alicia Johnson, Terrell's mother, doesn't live too far from this MAX station. And she heard the sirens that day. She didn't know that they were for her son. She found that out when some Portland police officers arrived at their house. And to her ears and eyes and heart, began interrogating her. She was in shock. And they were asking, you know, questions about, you know, where he's been. And you know, again, to her ears, what they were trying to do is indict Terrell, make him culpable for what Ajir had done to him. They didn't get a lot of answers. They tried to get answers from the DA. Didn't seem like there was much they were going to get from there. They got to see the videos. That was about it. They talked to people in the mayor's office. They seemed worried to talk to her. Not exactly empathetic or compassionate responses. Ultimately, the grand jury returned no indictment. And if you read the grand jury transcripts, it's no wonder. You have Portland police officers coming in to tell the grand jury all of, you know, two sentences about what the Constitution says about excessive force. You know, they're not exactly constitutional scholars to begin with. Secondly, they didn't exactly say precisely what should have this officer considered when using deadly force. You have trainers who, again, come in and, like the OIR report, which came after all this, highlight that the officers downplayed the violations of policy that this officer did. This officer was never disciplined for violating policy. He was found within policy and later was promoted.
So one, this Office of Independent Review group that the city of Portland hired to come in and do an investigation of this shooting, why did this city hire this California-based group?
Good question. I think it is common practice for municipalities to hire auditors for particularly these officer-involved shootings. That's a euphemism, you know, police shooting of people. And OIG has been doing this for a couple of years now, I want to say, and they were just hired again to write a report about the culture of the Portland Police Bureau. I've talked to investigators and some of the auditors in that office. They're thoughtful people. I mean, I think what we see time and again in the city is we love paying for studies. We love paying for people to tell us what our problems is. We don't want to do anything about it, though. And there's no point in having an audit that is toothless and doesn't have any kind of mandatory steps to follow after that.
But they did have some findings that are worth talking about, including how ineffective the Portland Police Review Board is. So talk about the findings of this independent review group.
Sure. So they did talk about the directives that weren't followed, like the foot chase directive. They talked about the fact that Officer Ajir was patrolling with his brother, Deputy Ajir, from a different bureau. That obviously creates conflicts of interest in other circumstances beyond, you know, what you would normally understand to be the blue code of silence. You know, so far as I'm aware, that wasn't necessarily an issue in this case. Maybe there was, but I think by most accounts, Deputy Ajir had not seen what happened. But I think what the OIR group really kind of highlights is what happened after here, which is this went through multiple levels of review within the Portland Police Bureau internally. And at each step, either the factors involving breaking the rules or just analyzing how this officer got to a position where he was suddenly shocked and scared and backing away with his gun were downplayed. And supervisors are meant to scrutinize these things, but it's really just a rubber stamp operation. You know, there is tacit review of this. And what really seems like a defiance of community oversight or transparency. A lot of this was not known to Alicia, I will add. She had struggled to get, I think, any kind of closure on this case until the OIR group presented their findings to city council. And, you know, Alicia asked point blank to one of the OIR presenters, you know, had Ajir followed his training, would my son be alive? And she heard a yes. So that I think really inspired her to, again, try to get a lawyer and investigate this. But again, it's you hear the story a lot with people killed by the Portland police. You don't know what happened to your kid until you sue. And I've been through enough of these that I can also tell you that on the defense side, they always try to poke holes in whatever it is you plead. They always act very offended that you accuse them of murdering somebody. And they want to pretend like they didn't have a hand in covering it up. I think probably they would get sued less if they actually, you know, were transparent with families, if they brought them in, if they apologized. I don't think that people are bringing wrongful death suits solely for the purpose of monetary compensation, much as they are owed that. They want to know what happened. They want closure. They want to feel like they're doing right by the spirit of the person who was taken from them. And I think that's what certainly motivated Alicia.
And speaking of what results in all of this, we know his mother did receive a $600,000 settlement in the case. What else came of this? I'm just wondering, when you think of what didn't happen here, Terrell Johnson is dead. Officer Ajir is still a police officer. In fact, he was promoted to sergeant. He was not held accountable. The settlement means that it absolves the city and the Portland Police Bureau of any guilt in Terrell Johnson's death. So where is the justice?
Oh, Lord, that is the hardest question to answer, I think, for anybody involved in the system. Maybe it's easy for some people. It's not for me. I recognize that this court system, the one that we built, the laws that we have, it's really only a measurement of, you know, insurance liability, so to speak. It's about, you know, actuarial charts and compensation for people. And that does mean something. That does mean that there is some level of compensation for what was done to you. But justice, that is just something that it is elusive in this system. And you really have to come up with your own terms, I think, on what it is that you're trying to get at from a lawsuit like this. Like I have to unfortunately tell a lot of clients, you're not going to get an apology. I think I've gotten one apology out of one lawsuit out of the several dozens that I've done so far. And I still didn't bring back that person's body part that they lost. If you settle these cases, you're settling it in exchange for them saying, yeah, I'm not apologizing, but here's money. If you beat them at trial, they're going to say, I'm disappointed in the jury. If you beat them later in the Court of Appeals, like, oh, well, you know, I think we would have won on the law on a different day with a different judge. You know, it is just not built into the adversarial system for there to be, I think, the type of restorative justice that people want or deserve. And this officer, he's actually no longer with the police bureau. He's now in Boise. You know, he's not on our streets anymore, but he's on other people's streets, and that concerns me.
So what good did come out of this? Alicia Johnson did not get her son back. What helped her to be satisfied with the outcome?
What was the hardest thing to tell her and to advise over the years of litigation in this case was, you know, we have to be disciplined and diligent about what it is that we do say about Terrell. And that includes, you know, basically not telling people what's going on in the case. That means not talking about Terrell, since, you know, your own familial bond with him is something we're going to have to put a dollar number on later. And that was the hardest thing for Alicia. And knowing that the case is done and over with, she can now talk about her son. She can memorialize him. She can, again, build a sense of community around his memory. And that's something that she just couldn't. She understood why, but that was still just very hard. And she now feels like she can hopefully find some peace in all this.
And what else came out of the lawsuit? Did any good come out of this?
Well, when we went in the city of Portland, you settle a case for more than, I think the threshold is $12,000. Might be lower. It has to go in front of city council for a vote. We use that opportunity to present to city council basically a little bit about Terrell and the loss that this family suffered because he was taken from them by Officer Ajir. Terrell's aunt and uncle testified, and it was I think highlighted the human element of any of these cases. I could talk all I want about the law. What matters to people is who it is that they loved and lost. And I think that was very impactful on several of the city commissioners. You know, the mayor spoke of his willingness to put more effort in the issue of mental health and mental illness services. And, you know, hopefully there's also some low-hanging fruit that maybe we'll be able to change as far as who it is that responds to a situation like this circumstance. Like, 4 years later, after this, just up the road at Lentz Park, Michael Delgado was shot by Zachary DeLong, a Portland police officer, from 90 feet away. Again, another man in a mental health crisis, seemingly, and he did not need to die that day. You know, we're decades late on this issue of when to send a police officer, when to send a crisis intervention person. And I'm hoping that, you know, it's another piece of the puzzle, you know, was placed in on the board today. And I'll add that getting a settlement or a judgment against the city for its police bureau, shockingly difficult. Portland Cop Watch has a list of the top 20 settlements against the city. And Terrell's case, the list hasn't been updated, but it would be certainly within the top 10 of settlements or judgments against the city. And earlier this year was the largest settlement against the Portland Police Bureau, the case for Quanice Hayes. So I have to believe that all of the activism, all of the swell of community support for the uprising for Black lives and generally police accountability has to have had an effect. And I think they're reading the same news that we are. And another thing, last year, during the uprising for Black lives, the mayor and the police bureau decided to pull the Portland police officers off the transit division. You know, I can't claim to say that that is clearly something that's related to our case, but it is obvious that had Ajir not been responding to issues on a Max platform like he was, Terrell would have been still with us. So we've criminalized so many aspects of people's lives, transit, housing, mental illness, all of those converged on one Max station. And I'm reminded of what happened with Oscar Grant down in Oakland on the BART train. A lot of people congregate in transit hubs, and we shouldn't be overly policing those places.
Thank you for listening.